Hey guys, and welcome to episode 131 of the OCDstories.com podcast. Now in this episode, I interview Shiva Rajai. I have interviewed Shiva before, and I encourage you to check that out. I will put the link in the show notes of this episode. But Shiva is a psychotherapist based in America. And in this, we get an update on her OCD story. Shiva herself has OCD, so we find out kind of where that's at and since we've last chatted. As we recorded the episode on Friday the 13th, Friday the 13th is obviously quite a superstitious time for some people. And with OCD, some people's OCD can latch onto that. So we use that as a starting point for the conversation to talk about superstition and how that can play into OCD. We talk about avoidance because she's been covering it quite a lot on Instagram. And obviously avoidance is a huge part of OCD. I ask Shiva about how to accept that there might always be unanswered questions in the mind. With OCD, we want certainty. We want to answer that question, that what if. So she does a good job at answering that. I ask her about why the two words "so what" are the most important in the treatment of anxiety disorders. We talk a bit about meditation. She gives her personal stance and take on that. And then plenty more questions after that, going into general OCD recovery and treatment. The audio quality for this is a bit off on this particular episode. For some reason, my voice is quieter than normal, but Shiva's is perfectly loud and fine. So bear with it when I'm talking and then when Shiva's talking. And obviously, she's the guest, so the majority of the conversation will be coming from her. So all is good. So without further ado, here is Shiva.
On the podcast today, I have Shiva Rajai. Shiva is a psychotherapist who specializes in the treatment of obsessive compulsive disorder and other related anxiety disorders. Shiva did a TED talk called Addicted to the Answer, Anxiety in the Age of Information, which made up the core of our first podcast together. Welcome back to the show, Shiva.
Thank you so much for having me, Stu. It's great to be back.
It's good to have you back on. Your episode did quite well before and I enjoyed it. So it's good to have you here.
Thank you.
All right. So, you know, before, as I mentioned earlier on, you shared some of your OCD story in the first episode. So it'd be good to kind of see where you're at and what you've been since we last spoke.
Of course. So I do have OCD and have since I was quite young, though. And your listeners who might have seen my last episode know that I wasn't until my early, sort of like my mid-20s, that I received the diagnosis. Like so many of us, it can take a while and can take a lot of very good-minded therapists, but sometimes misguided before you get there. And so I still have OCD, surprise, surprise. And that has been, that has continued to be a part of my work and my life. I've recently opened a private practice in the Orange County area. And so, you know, one of the interesting things, I think, just the OCD dynamic in that is that for many people, I think that can be a really daunting change. Of course, for anybody, that's a big unknown. And sometimes I talk with clients about how, you know, when you're going into any unknown, you're going to have spikes in your anxiety. It's likely that with big changes, you're going to experience a sense of upheaval, a sense of maybe disconnectedness. And I felt that too. So in transitioning, there's just a lot of what ifs. You know, what is this new venture going to look like? What's it going to feel like? And how's it going to go? And I think that definitely reflected in my anxiety and just required me to take a little bit more time with myself. And to do that practice of continually turning back towards the work, I think we can kind of get farther from it and closer to it. And it's sort of like a breathing process. But I can definitely say with the starting of the new practice, I had to sort of reconnect with the work again.
Yeah. Okay. No, thank you for sharing that. And did your OCD kind of latch on the added responsibility you now have, I guess, around issues like safeguarding, and because you don't necessarily have a team around you?
Right. Yes, it was a lot of, I think as a lot of OCD is, anticipatory anxiety. And I'm happy to say that once I sort of got into it and began doing the day-to-day process of having your own business and managing clients and payments and the details and nuances. As usual, it wasn't as scary as my brain had made it out to be. But there was definitely a lot of that anticipatory what-ifing beforehand. So I imagine that that will never really go away, but maybe just lessen in volume.
Good to hear. And so you said they're kind of leaning back into the work and enjoying it more. Is that as simple as it just naturally happened, or is it a conscious effort to kind of focus more back in on what you're doing?
That's a great question. The way that it has felt for me, because I have had to and been able to, you know, lean back into the work countless times, as we all have to. And for me, I think there's usually a phase where I sort of think, you know, do I really need to? And let me be clear, every day you're working. You know, I think there's like daily reminders of tolerating the unknown. There's little exposures that one might push themselves into. And that's kind of that maintenance mindset that I've talked about before too. But I think there's a bit of a difference, at least for me, between doing that sort of day-to-day maintenance versus maybe actually going back and looking at the texts again, revisiting some concepts, turning up my mindfulness practice, really intentionally turning back towards the work. And I think for me, it goes from, okay, maybe I'm going to need this. This is getting a little bit rockier, to something usually happens. I'll have some kind of high anxiety week or something, and I'll go, yep, I need to turn back and just revisit. And I'm grateful it's there. I'm grateful that foundation's there.
Absolutely. And good to hear you got that practice. So we're obviously recording this on Friday the 13th, which is quite a superstitious day and date. And also the number 13 can be perceived as unlucky. So I guess it'd be good to chat about superstition and how that plays into OCD.
Yeah, I love this. I think this is this can be kind of a fun thing to talk about on Friday the 13th. There are kind of other unlucky or auspicious days. Sometimes my clients will bring things up like this around, you know, Halloween time. Just sort of what we might consider unlucky. Actually, September 11th can be another one that feels a little bit triggering and unlucky. And superstition, I find this interesting. I see this with some of my clients. So my background, for anybody who doesn't know, I'm Iranian-American, and both my parents are Iranian immigrants. And I find that there's definitely, I think I want to start by sort of acknowledging the cultural angle on superstition, that for many cultures, superstition is it's very acceptable, it's very typical to sort of think about the world superstitiously. And, you know, I can remember countless examples of sort of my grandparents, superstition is just a part of, it's, you know, that's the way you do it. You touch wood, you know, you don't pick up a penny when it's on the tail side. And that's just sort of was ingrained. But I think superstition, what it really is when we look at it, it's another attempt, I think, to wrestle with and make sense of the unknown. And I think it's the unknown, and it's also the randomness of being alive, sort of like the randomness of the human experience that we all experience. And of course, that's a very scary and oftentimes disconcerting experience. We're very familiar with that with OCD treatment. It's, you know, the unknown is quite frightening, quite exciting, but also quite frightening. And I think that superstition is an attempt to control. It's sort of an attempt to make meaning. And of course, it's frequently not, frequently doesn't work. I think it's a form of sort of this magical thinking. But I think to understand where it comes from this temptation to want to make sense of our world, to feel in control of our world, and to feel as if we can control some of the randomness of the human experience, I think that's sort of where superstition comes into play. And certainly for a person who struggles with the unknown and feels more sensitive in the face of the unknown, superstition can be tempting.
Absolutely. And it's a compulsion, basically, isn't it? That, again, like the saying, if you step on a crack, you break your mother's back. So then people, especially in England, and you're nodding there, so I'm sure it's the same in America, we will avoid cracks, even to this day, if you get three kind of drain holes or manhole covers in a row, you've got to kind of, you can't walk across all three. You have to skip the first one or the last one or the middle. And I'll still find myself now kind of occasionally doing that if I'm not careful. And it's, yeah, like you said, it's a release valve, right, to lower that anxiety.
Exactly. I had a client recently who was sort of gave me the OCD argument back, which was, well, why not, Shiva? You know, well, why shouldn't I just take that extra step and just be absolutely certain that I don't ruin my day? And, you know, of course, I think that's the tempting question in all of us. And I responded back to her, you know, of course you could, and maybe even you could feel as if you have controlled that one part of your life. But of course, what you're really doing, and there's the compulsion, is you're reinforcing that need for control and that need to feel like your life is something that you can predict.
Yeah, really good point. Okay, so I feel there's a solution to this, but there's some questions I want to ask later. So I'll wait for that to maybe tie it back.
Sure.
I know it's on your Instagram today, but judging by our time difference, it was probably yesterday you posted this, which was about avoidance. So I think you were making your day around talking about avoidance. So I guess just to share on this podcast, kind of what you were sharing on social media about avoidance.
I'd love to. So I recently, I'll be transparent here, I recently realized, that post was actually quite personal to me, in that I recently realized that there was a part of my life that I was using quite compulsively, quite avoidantly and compulsively. And it was something that had sort of hidden under the surface. I had basically been a competitive equestrian for many years, and I grew up doing it as a way to really take care of myself and to sort of escape some stuff that was going on at home. And it basically morphed into this very elaborate world for me, where I found a lot of refuge and a lot of solace, and was able to sort of turn to. And over the last few months or so, I've been coming to terms with the realization that I've been avoiding my own growth in this realm of my life. And I made a point in the post that I wrote to note that socially, there are certain things that are rewarded versus avoidances that are sort of not rewarded or seen as, you know, okay, that's bad, you know, I'm wagging my finger, that's bad. And I think that exercise is a realm of life that we can frequently avoid into, use as avoidance, use as compulsion, use as escape. But it's generally seen as, wow, so great. You know, that person is working out 6 days a week, 7 days a week for 2 hours, or wow, so great. You know, that individual is so dedicated to their work. That person is so social. You know, there's so many ways in which I think we can divert that path, you know, the path of growth and the path of discomfort. And for me, I was using really this sport and this hobby and this world in a way that was, you know, it began to backfire on me. And so I wrote this post because it was very personal to me. I'm now sort of on the other side of it. I decided to cold turkey quit my passion and hobby of 20 something years. And it was huge. And of course, you know, like many things, I realized that the fear of doing it is, of course, so much greater than the pain of actually moving through and being in my life. So I'm sorry to give you that long-winded background, but that inspired the post. And I think we have to be aware not only of the more obvious avoidances that we might engage in. I made a couple of examples there. Social anxiety has some obvious avoidance strategies, maybe avoiding a party. Whereas, you know, and for example, agoraphobia, I use that example, of course, you know, that person is quite obviously avoiding being in the world in a certain way. But there are so many little, more unconscious or behind the scenes avoidances that I think are worth looking at.
Yeah, really, really good. And thank you for sharing. And is it, I guess, does that come down to then like a values piece of why am I doing this? For example, am I horse riding because I love it, or am I horse riding because I'm avoiding something? Or, you know, am I avoiding the party because I just love being by myself, or am I avoiding the party because really I'm scared to socialize, be vulnerable? Does it come down to that?
I absolutely think that it does, and I think that that's a great way to sort of distinguish maybe the parts of our life that are genuinely fueling us, and how we use them versus when something that maybe even once was fueling us, a habit, a hobby, a profession, anything that once was fueling us that maybe now is being used in a way that is avoidant. And I think that's a great way to make that distinction where you ask yourself, you know, is this something that I feel that I want to do? Can I have a, you know, casual relationship with it? For example, if I miss a day of working out, or if I miss a day of this hobby, this sport, how does that feel? You know, how do I feel about that? Is that okay? And that's a shame. I would have loved to have gone. Or does it really feel threatening? And that's a little bit on my post where I was talking about the difference between, you know, wanting to do something versus needing, which is oftentimes how we talk with clients about the difference between compulsive and non-compulsive behavior.
No, absolutely. Great distinction. And I guess personal question, what made you go cold turkey versus, say, just cutting your activity by 80%?
That's a great question. I think I realized that I had tried to be more moderate about it and was unable to really get the clarity and distance that I needed. I just had a sense that I really needed to get some distance from how I felt about the sport and what it was doing for me. And I think proved to myself that I could be, you know, fully in my life without the crutch.
Yeah, no, I completely understand. I get it. I did similar with alcohol nearly a year ago now. Because I didn't necessarily have an unhealthy relationship with alcohol, but I deemed that it was an unhealthy substance for me personally. And I couldn't limit myself to say a couple nights a week I have a couple beers because I enjoy it. For me, it was kind of all or nothing, so I had to cut it out completely and get that distinction. And coming up to a year, I'll probably continue, but I didn't go into I went it just give myself a year, but like you said, I had to go kind of cold turkey to renew that relationship.
Yeah, I was going to ask if you have sort of like revisited that relationship by now, maybe whatever that is, maybe a glass of wine or whatever it is. Have you found a way to sort of, do you want that relationship again? I wonder where you're at with it.
Yeah, good question. I do miss the taste of a cold beer. And especially now that it's summer, it's been very hot here in the UK recently, by our standards anyway, not compared to LA at the minute. But what I found is there's some very good non-alcoholic beers now that taste basically the same as lager. It's hard to get like ale. In the UK we have ale, which is very popular, but you can't really get non-alcoholic versions of that so easily. But lager, like Budweiser, they do a good non-alcoholic beer. And for me, it does the same thing. I still drink it. I love the taste. And it quenches that part of me, that nostalgic part of beer's refreshing. But I don't wake up with a hangover. I don't make any stupid decisions or say anything.
I love that so much because I think a little bit of what I'm like hearing in that is the ritual. And I think that's part of what can sort of fuel, you know, and this is a strong word, we can use it in different degrees, but like addictive behavior, reliant behavior is that ritual. And I think for me too, it's like going to the barn and being there in the morning and the smell and the animals and the sounds and the physicality of it, that became part of what I sort of craved. And that's so interesting. I mean, I think you have given me an idea there. I think the idea might be, how do you take part of what, you know, made that world so relaxing in a way and bring it, you know, bring it without the reliance?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's a good point. And yeah, I get that ritual. I get the enjoyment, the taste of it, but without the druggy part of alcohol.
Yeah.
Because it is a drug. We have to admit that. No judgment there, but just name of facts. And my friend who quit smoking, he really enjoyed going out of an evening and having kind of the last cigarette before bed and just looking up at the stars, because he lived in the countryside. So what he did was, when he quit, was he still went out about 11 p.m. each night and had a cup of tea and just looked up at the stars and took deep breaths, like you do when you smoke a cigarette. And And for him, that helped because he still kept that part of smoking that he enjoyed, but without the nicotine and tar, etc.
Yeah, that's great. That's great sort of stuff for me to think about as I'm making this transition over the last few months. That's great for me to think about. And it reminds me of, too, I'll have clients come in sometimes and we'll be doing family history work with them. And I'll sort of ask, is there any genetic predisposition? Have you seen any anxiety or depression in the family? And many people will say, no, but my father was an alcoholic. No, but my grandfather had an addiction problem. And of course, I don't know those individuals and I can't speak for sure, but you think about addiction as an escape. And so what led that person to feel as if they needed that escape? And frequently there is an anxiety or depressive undertone there, of course. So I do wonder if when we struggle with OCD and heightened anxiety or biological heightened anxiety, if many of us are maybe more tempted than others to seek escapist behaviors. And I think I encourage your listeners, and I encourage myself to do this too, to just take inventory on our lives and to see where things start to feel like maybe we're gripping too tightly, to be curious about that grip.
Yeah. I was making it now. That's a very good point. And I feel we use many things as crutches, and I feel that then feeds into the OCD, because OCD is like the severe end of things. But what are we doing in our everyday life that isn't the disorder part, but that ultimately is the same behavior? And the amount of times I hear people on the course I'm doing now, maybe it's just sharing too much, but anyway, I'm sure it just represents a lot of society. But like they say, if they've had a tough day, I'm going to go home and have a few gin and tonics or whatever. And I'm like, you're effectively just escaping the stress of the day instead of dealing with it and letting it go through a walk or meditation or a conversation with someone. And again, I don't want to sound like I'm bashing alcohol, but the way they're using alcohol is not healthy.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
If you have OCD, then you're kind of nurturing that compulsive part of your brain.
Yeah. I think I had a question recently actually on that same post about, the difference between, distraction and avoidance. And I think a little bit, you're touching a little bit on that too. It's like, well, is there a healthy distraction and is there a healthy avoidance? And that, that's a tough one. I think my recommendation is, so I'm sort of speaking to my commenter who I haven't had a chance to actually respond to yet, but I'm speaking to you, commenter, that I think if you address first, if you allow yourself at least a bit of time to sit with and be curious about that discomfort, to be with it, then sometimes I think a redirection, some people call that a distraction, but I think a redirection can have its purposes. It can allow us to then, okay, I'm going to re-engage in my values, right? I'm going to re-engage in my family. I'm going to go work out. That matters to me. So I think that redirection has its place, but I certainly think that can't be our go-to.
Yeah, that's true. And if you give it that space and that time, then when you come to have that G&T, for example, or watch the TV, you're then doing it from a better place of, actually, I'm doing this because I want to enjoy this drink, or I want to enjoy this box set, whatever it is, instead of I'm doing it because I just want to get out of my head.
Absolutely. You're developing that want versus need.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, cool. No, thank you. So I put it here, and this is again from one of your posts, I can't remember which one, but it's how can you accept that there might always be an unanswered question in your mind? Which obviously with OCD, you're nodding there, because obviously there's no video anymore, but we want an answer, we want it now, there's urgency, there's pressure. And when you're first dealing with that and learning to live with uncertainty, the idea of ever keeping the open question in your head is a torturous concept. So I guess, how do you explain that and any advice?
Oh, yeah. Right. This is, I think, advance isn't the word. It's such a deep level of acceptance, I think, to come to this point, and a critical level of acceptance to the long-term management of OCD. it's hard to put it this bluntly, but I think it's necessary. We must accept this. And the individuals who find the longest term, I think, success in their management of OCD, they are able to, they have come to the point where this is tolerable to them. They have developed that tolerance to sit with the, I love how you called it like an open question, like the unanswered question. So I think that there's a concept here, and it's a little bit roundabout, but I will get back to that. I think about it as concentric circles of acceptance. This is some, a way I sort of describe it to my clients, and I see through my treatment that acceptance a lot of times works in this way where you'll start with, so concentric circles being circles within circles. So you'll start with maybe that main circle of, wow, I have OCD. This is a diagnosis. This is a mental health disorder. And that takes an opening up around, a softening up and around. Some of my clients come to that point within weeks, and some take months to come to the point where they go, I have this. And I'll oftentimes say, it doesn't matter if it's called a diagnosis, you know, you have a heightened level of anxiety, you have these intrusive thoughts, you can call it what you want, but that is there. And then there might be maybe a second ring or a third ring around it, around pain and suffering, that we must accept the experience of pain. Because the reality is our brains are wired to be more vigilant and to experience threat in a heightened way. And we're going to feel more of it than sort of your neurotypical individual. So that might be a rung of acceptance too. And somewhere along the sort of outer rungs, I believe this idea of the unknown question, I think it sits there. And I think it sits in the outer rungs because from what I've seen in working with clients, that is sometimes the most poignant, difficult, and I don't want to use the word final, but I think it's towards the end of treatment where people can get to this point and go, I'm never going to know, am I, Shiva? Oh, and when I hear that, I just get so, it's like a, there's a melancholy to it because I know how painful that is, but I'm also so excited for them because that is true recovery, is to be able to sit with that. I'm never going to know. I'm never going to be 100% sure. And how do I think about it as walking through life with doubt next to you, or walking through life with this question of, I'm not really sure if I'm in love. Like, I'm going to be in my marriage. I'm going to commit. I'm going to, you know, make love, be in love, act in love, but I don't know for sure. You know, I'm going to be a parent to these children, and I have to live with the possibility that one day I might snap and do something unspeakable. But that is, oh, it's such a door to long-lasting OCD maintenance, and I use that word recovery carefully, but what recovery looks like for us.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And yeah, I love those 3 points in the concentric circles. I've never heard it explained like that. I will use that idea, but I will quote you. So. I think there's a good distinction there, because I can imagine right now there's several thousand people listening to this freaking out because the idea of never getting an answer. And I can't say too much because of reassurance, but what I will say is that I still don't have an answer to many of my original kind of obsessions and worries, but the emotional intensity that was once there is either smaller or it's gone, depending on the concern. And that's the distinction I think people don't realize when they hear that, like, I'm never going to get an answer, because they hear that and they think, I'm always going to suffer in terms of the emotional pain, the anxiety or the grief, shame, okay, whatever it is. And that emotion's fleeting, and they will go, and then the open question probably won't even matter to you anymore. I probably did reassure there, but
I really appreciate that you said that, because you're so right. I think that can feel, maybe that message of the unanswerable question can feel really overwhelming, especially depending on where you're at in your recovery. I think individuals who have been maybe a little further along, they kind of are aware that, oh, that feels so overwhelming, but I kind of know what Stu and Shiva mean by that. But certainly, I think when you're starting out in the beginning, that seems unbearable. So I really appreciate you making that distinction. I think that's a helpful reassurance. I think there's many unhelpful ones, but yes, I couldn't agree with you more. When you get to that point, it won't feel impossible. When you work through the exposure and response prevention, you work up the ladder. And I think maybe that's why I put it at the end of the concentric circle, sort of the last rung. I think you truly have to practice to get there.
Yeah.
And I want to reiterate, too, a couple of things. I think one is OCD lives in unanswerable questions. OCD is attracted to and fueled by unanswerable questions. It makes perfect sense. If we could answer them with some ease, OCD wouldn't be a thing. And so I think I don't like to make OCD sort of the evil guy, but this idea of like it preying on the unanswerable question.
Yeah.
And to remind ourselves that this is not just an OCD specific experience. Yes, the exaggerated pain, the intense vigilance we feel around the question is OCD, but human experience is unanswerable questions. That to be human, and to be human successfully, I believe, is to make peace with unanswerable questions. So we're not alone. We might feel the experience more intensely and fixate on it because of our disorder, but we're human. This is part of being alive.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. We as humans generally, there's so much we don't acknowledge on a day-to-day basis that could make anyone kind of shake in their boots. I was camping the other night and we were in Wales under the stars and could see the stars, and then my brain went kind of, you know, there's just nothing but distance and space and galaxies, and now I'm on this floating rock ball with nothing holding us up. Bar this concept of space, which we probably don't really know. I'm sure physicists can correct me here, but so, and then my brain starts potentially freaking out about that, and obviously I rein it in, but like there's so many levels that anyone can freak out about.
Yeah, you went to the space panic moment, right? I think anyone can. That's such a good example because I think anybody can go there. I think another one that maybe can help us feel a little more connected is the unknown of the end, like our own personal end. I sometimes ask my clients, you know, you don't know how you're going to die one day, but you know that you will. And how many hours or how many minutes a day do you spend worrying about the possibility of death? They go, none at all. Most of them say that. Of course, some people come in for that exact fear, but most people go, none at all. And I go, well, why? And they go, well, I know it's going to happen. I've accepted it. And sometimes I'll use that as a parallel to what acceptance of the unknown really has to feel like.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, really good way of doing it. I'm laughing because I had that same worry today about dying. And that's usually a concept that I'm very accepting of, and I've made peace with my philosophical beliefs about what death is, but for some reason today those beliefs left me, and I was left with a real fear of uncertainty. But it was fleeting, thankfully. Okay.
So, did you turn? I'm just curious. Did you sort of like turn away from it? How did you sort of?
I kind of ran with the story in my head for a bit, and then I kind of caught it. And I'm trying to think what I did. I think I just practiced. Yeah, just practice acceptance. Well, it's going to happen. I can't do anything about it. So why am I worrying about it? I guess I reassured myself by remembering a particular philosophy around death that appeases my mind and my worries, which could potentially be seen as a compulsion. But I don't necessarily see that worry for me as an OCD worry. So,
right. I think that's a very fair human concern. I do.
Yeah. But yeah, the way I think about it is, well, when I'm dead, I'm not even going to know. So. Okay. In one of your posts, you put two words that you said were the most powerful words for treating anxiety disorders, which is so what? If you could explain that concept.
Wow, yes. So what? Which is actually very, your timing's perfect on that, because I think maybe you didn't say so what, but you acted so what. Acceptance is a form of so what. So you sort of acted that, and you were able to escape death, so to speak. You didn't, but in the moment.
Yeah.
So the idea of so what, I want to say I love the way, I think this is Stephen Phillipson who describes it this way, as the expressing of irrelevance to the mind. Yeah. And I think that that's a great way to discuss the efficacy of this idea of so what. So when we remember that this is a neurobiological disorder and that our brain is sending out these false signals of threat, these faulty or exaggerated signals of threat, it's really important, I think, to remember that we have power over the response to that. Of course, that's the only thing we have power over. And so to express to our afraid mind, our mind that is, it's not mean. Again, I really don't like to describe OCD as like this evil presence, although of course it feels very scary and sometimes feels sinister, but it is that overact, it's that sort of like overattentive best friend or that sort of like overprotective parent. So there's this, I want to take care of you energy coming from the brain, and it's just misguided, and we need to teach the brain that we're okay. So part of how we can teach our brain that, you know what, these messages that you're sending, hey, I appreciate your concern for me, but it's not really important, is that we can turn to our mind when it's sending these, hey, Shiva, Stu, look out, this is important, and sort of be like, it's not, you know, it's really not, and I'm okay with that possibility. I'm able to say, you know what, it's okay if that happens, or so what. Now, a lot of times, when I sort of describe this concept, I think clients will get very nervous about, well, does this mean I'm accepting the content of the thought? Well, Shiva, if I say, so what? Yeah, so what? Okay, what if I, hurt someone tomorrow? Or so what if I'm lying in my relationship and I'm not in the right relationship? I want to make it clear, you know, it's not about accepting the content. It's about accepting the possibility. So really, when you're saying so what to your mind, when you're sending that message of this is not relevant to me, this is not important enough to me, it's not that you're saying I don't care if that happens. You're simply saying the proportion with which I'm being yelled at about this doesn't match reality.
Yeah, I agree. And it's very much like an ACT phrase, acceptance and commitment therapy. It's that kind of, as Russ Harris says, kind of thanks brain. Like, thank you for telling me that, but it's useless. Or thank you anyway, I've acknowledged it, now go away, sort of thing. I like that. I think that's, and you know, I know what's helped me before is having a sort of mantras or sayings like that that kind of just remind me to kind of let things go, or try and accept the, as you said there, the possibility that it's, that it could come true and that it may not come true.
Yeah, and I think that there's Kimberly Quinlan, I love Kimberly's work, and I remember her doing this when we were back at OCDLA. She would shrug her shoulders, and she would, it was a very physical experience, she'd go, okay, so what? And she would shrug her shoulders, and I think sometimes getting into it, almost like acting the part of so what, okay, so what? You know, there's a whole physical, like, it's almost as if sometimes I describe it as like OCD wants to grip you and you're sand going through its fingers. You're sort of, you become very flexible when you say that phrase. And when you literally do something like shrug your shoulders and throw your hands up, not in a message of defeat. You know, so what isn't giving up. So what is accepting what you can change versus what you can't.
Yeah, just like the serenity prayer. I'll butcher it if I try and remember it, but I think that's great, and I think the idea, as you said there about Kim shrugging her shoulders, and I find anyway with anxiety, people, definitely me, kind of play small, my body goes smaller, it freezes, it locks, it's not fluid, and like you said there, doing your shoulders with the kind of so what movement kind of loosens your body up again, which is not what anxiety wants you to do, because you're making yourself bigger, which means you're, if there's a tiger in front of you, it's going to see you, which is effectively what's going on in the brain. Okay, so where is my question? Yeah, so I've got a question here around mindfulness and meditation. So this is a question for you specifically, as opposed to general advice, is how do you practice mindfulness or meditation?
Sure. So I think I've actually written on my page about, my the word is struggle, but I think it's really more typical of sort of staying in a meditative place, keeping a practice going. I think this is something that, you know, like much self-care can be one of the first things that slips when we feel a bit overwhelmed or when there's too much going on in your personal life, your professional life. But I really try to meditate, actually meditate, sit down for 10, 15 minutes. I'll be quite honest, I don't make it to maybe 20. But even if I get 10, 15 minutes in once a day, I find that really helpful. How I see it for myself is the brain is a muscle, like all other muscles, and I'm working out the muscle that pulls me out of the monkey mind. So I almost imagine, I know this isn't how the brain is structured, of course, but I almost imagine that there's a muscle that's sort of connecting me from the front to the back, from the monkey mind to the more observant brain. And I think about it as, well, we go to the gym for so many other parts of our body, we keep ourselves healthy. Meditation, the practice of stillness, is pulling that muscle, you know, and making that muscle more strong so you can pull yourself back. Because I personally am in my head quite a bit. I think many of your listeners are, and it's not a natural process for me to sit and observe. It's very much something I have to practice. So daily meditation is something I aspire to. I feel much better when I do. I love being in nature. This sounds really silly, but I will literally stop and smell roses because I find that scent is something that really puts me in the present moment. So sometimes I'll get sort of like the manufactured roses that don't smell like anything, and that's a little disappointing. But if you can find great, you know, the great smell of flowers, I will literally stop when I'm walking my dog. He's very upset at this, and I'll turn and sort of like smell roses. And I know I must look a bit ridiculous, but for that moment, I'm completely there, and I'm completely sort of, I think I'm checked back in to these greater truths that mindfulness gives us.
Yeah, no, that's great to hear. I'm reading a book at the minute on, I'm going to butcher this, but it's something like Shinrin Yoku, the Japanese, I blatantly said that wrong, but anyway, the Japanese, I don't know if you want to call it art or science, of just spending time in nature and the effects that has on mental health and on physical. From the 80s, the Japanese government have put a lot of research into this and found some good findings on both mental health and physical health. But the reason I brought this up was because in there they talk about this on like four, I'm going to say hormones, don't quote me on this. Anyway, the trees give off. And when we're around trees, we're breathing these in. And it does lots of like physiological things to our body, like lowers stress, reduces cortisol and stuff like that. Wow. And they found all this through their research. So this particular scientist that wrote the book, he pumps the kind of whatever it is hormone into his flat or wherever. So I'm sure there's probably the same for flowers, like you said.
Yeah, I think it's key to sort of like remember that's how we develop, that's the environment in which we developed, and it's always fascinating to me that so much of what people are sort of discovering now about health and well-being and stress reduction, it's these old practices and these old ways of being that we have lost and are now, you know, reconnecting with. And I know not everybody has access to beautiful woods outside their, you know, their flat, their apartment. Some people live in the city and that can be quite noisy and overwhelming. But even something like, you know, buying fresh cut flowers and leaving them in your home, keeping your home sort of like clutter free. I mean, these are ways in which I think that we can create a sense of peace and inner stillness that doesn't necessarily require you to live in Montana.
It's a very, very good point. And I think I've mentioned this before on the podcast, but I've got a couple massive kind of green plant things in my apartment. And I used to not like them because they were so big. They were my wife's. Anyway, they take up so much space. But when we went on holiday, we took them to a friend so they could be watered and looked after. And when we came back off holiday, we hadn't got the plants back. And the apartment just felt sterile and empty. And just having those plants there just made it so natural, organic, like it just felt right in my soul, if I want to use that word.
Yeah, I wonder if because that's sort of like our human, you know, we all evolved in nature. I wonder if that would, it's a broad statement to say it would work for everybody, but I think some type of connection to the natural environment, to nature, whether it's, like you said, looking out at the stars at night, you know, sometimes driving to the ocean to see the sunset if you're close to that, or just, you know, stopping and smelling flowers, petting your animal. If you have a pet, the act of just being with that real, I think, fundamental energy can be really, really mindful and rejuvenative.
Absolutely. I completely agree. And kind of you said, like what you're saying with the roses, for me, nature, there's so many anchor points that just draw you back in. Like water's a big one for me. If I sit and watch a lake or a river, no matter where my mind is, within 10 minutes, I'm mesmerized by it and I'm naturally being pulled into this meditative state. And it's obviously different for different people, but there's birds, there's, depending where you live, bears, there's various trees. Running out of things here, so I'm gonna stop. So, I guess what have you learned in the last couple years of treating people from say 2 years ago to now? Is there anything you've learned in particular about OCD treatment or that your views changed?
I think it's, you know, I think that I've learned quite a bit. I think I've learned so much. I think something that I'll jump on again. I think there's so many ways to answer that question. I'm always really blown away by the people that I work with. I'm really blown away by these people who have OCD, who deal with pain, who sort of like decide to walk this road. So this isn't exactly about what I've maybe learned from a clinical sense, but I think that I feel very grateful to work with this population. And again, that's a clinical way to say it. But I sometimes say in my work that OCD is as much a disorder as it is a personality type. And that's because I think this particular brand of pain does something to us. I think the vigilance makes us intelligent. I think that the sensitivity makes us thoughtful. I think there are so many positive characteristics and fascinating qualities that come with, you know, this particular like pain construct. And that is an overgeneralization. But to be honest, many of us, I think, have a lot in common. And I love that over the years, I think my respect for those who go through this path, those who decide to face pain, my respect has grown, my admiration has grown, and I think it's inspired me just about, you know, my own struggle with OCD and my own relationship to pain. So I think I'm more grateful as the years go by. I'm really more grateful for the work that I do, and I'm just in awe. It's a really tough road, and I think it's such an honor to work with people who sort of go, you know what, I'm not going to avoid, I'm not going to hurt the people around me as a result of this because I'm not willing. I'm going to do something about it. It's really cool.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I agree with everything you said. I think they often say the environment makes a person. You take one person, put them in a different environment, they become a completely different person. And for me, with OCD, the environment's in your head, and it forces you to be a better person, I think, because often the fears and worries are around hurting someone else, or something bad happening, or you contaminating someone or contaminating yourself, and you're forced to raise your standards, I think, especially at a young age. And that's why, like you said, you meet so many people with OCD, and generally speaking, they're just the nicest people. And for me, it's something I've noticed recently is when you see someone really going through ERP and they're doing it and their subs are at like a 9 or a 10 and they're shaking with anxiety or whatever, but they're not giving in and they're kind of seeing it through. To me, that's the pinnacle of like beauty within humanity. If there is such a thing as like, I don't know, like the beauty of the human spirit, it's in that moment when they're struggling the most but refuse to give up. That, to me, just makes me proud to be human. I can say that.
I think that is that's so true, and I think I truly believe, Stu, you're going to love the direction you're heading in. You know, being able to work more closely with these amazing individuals, and you know, I think it's really having OCD is an education in pain. And sometimes we, you know, we always get it when we don't want it. Nobody wants an education in pain. Nobody asks for that. And you know, some people get it really early in life. And almost all of us get it in an unexpected way. But those of us who take that challenge up and decide to walk with it, I really believe there's a way to live life to its fullest on the other side. So I'm just in awe. I consider myself really privileged.
Excellent. No, that's great to hear. I couldn't agree more. Okay, so what would you tell your 20-year-old self if you could pick up the phone?
Girl. I've thought about this a lot. I was so scared at 20. I was so scared, and I was living such a small life at 20. I was like brand new to a huge college, you know, first time leaving the suburbs, and my OCD was hitting hard. And I think a lot about what would I say to her. It's hard because I think the advice I would give her, it wouldn't work. I think she was too scared and she didn't know enough, but I certainly would say, Shiva, you know, it's okay. Take the risk, you know, go to the party, date the boy, do the thing, because I think I was just terrified to live fully. And you know, it's hard, Stu. I think I wouldn't have it any other way at the same time, because that brought me here. And, I mean, you know, just tell her you're doing good, kid. Hang in there. You're going to like where you end up one day.
Yeah, really good message. And like you say, it's tough to if you're now happy with where you are or like in the direction, it's hard to want to change anything because you effectively wouldn't be who you are and you probably wouldn't be speaking to me now.
Yeah, and I think that that pain, like the pain can really be an opportunity, and that struggle can really be an opportunity, and it's really what we make of it. And we're tested so many times in our life. We're tested so many times. And I mean, it's amazing that there's, you know, there's things in place in like this podcast too, where you offer guidance and wisdom, because I think the one thing I really wish I could have given my 20-year-old self was just the knowledge of what was going on. Because it took me years before I really figured out that this was OCD and this had a name and this had a treatment. I think, you know, I just thought I was going crazy.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's a common fear and worry, right? Yeah, no, good answer. And, before we end, is there anything else that I haven't asked you that you wish you could have shared on the show?
I think that maybe if I could just leave your listeners with like just a little practice for maybe today, if they choose to practice it. It's something I've been thinking about. It's just been on my mind the last week, and it's been coming up with clients a lot. But to sort of recognize the urge to assign meaning, sort of talk about it as meaning making. And maybe you guys out there could just practice today one thing that you allow to sit without meaning, without making that connection. Because my guess is a lot of you are amazing at making meaning, and maybe it serves you in plenty of areas of your life. But when it comes to your anxiety, maybe just try one thing today gets to be left, whether that's unsolved or, you know, undone or without meaning.
Starting because I completely agree. I think we attach so much meaning to everything, especially with OCD, and that's a good practice to start to loosen that. Not everything has to have meaning.
Yeah, it's I think it's, again, it's such a skill. It's such a skill to be able to make connections and meaning, and I think it's a skill that's oftentimes born out of pain, that we develop that ability to meaning make. And I think part of really OCD work is being deliberate about where you use your skills, being deliberate about where you use your wonderful skill of analysis, your wonderful skill of meaning making, your wonderful skill of digging mentally. There's such a time and place for that, I think, in our lives. And there's also times and places where maybe we take a break.
Yeah, absolutely. And probably a good opportunity to practice some mindfulness in that moment instead of meaning making.
Smell the roses.
Yeah, smell the roses. Okay, Dave, so thank you for coming on and also sharing some insight. And as always, I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Stu. My pleasure.
So there you have it. I hope you enjoyed my episode with Shiva. And all the resources and links, etc., will be in the show notes to this episode, which can be found at theocdstories.com/podcast. And quick disclaimer, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.